Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets, a family podcast of pirates and penguins. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day.
So, yeah, we don't...
We're not Valentine's people.
We've talked about this. Like, we're not really, like, presents people. We're not, like... Hallmark holidays sorts of folks. We're really low key with stuff like
which is not to say that if you love the Valentine's Day, I think that there's anything wrong with that, but
it's just that both of us, we happen to both be luckily people who for these things are not all that important for us, which makes it easier, because if it were important to you and not to me, or vice versa,
that mismatch is difficult.
It'd be a difficult mismatch. Yeah. I mean, I think it's just laid back and not lazy, but
both. Maybe. Like,
couldn't be bothered. We were talking about this the other day, and the idea that, again, if you want to do this, if you want to celebrate the holiday however you want, that's no skin off my nose, but the whole, like, you have to go out and buy $40 for a dozen of roses when it's like $12 all the other rest of the time of the year on this particular day, or you don't love me, you get that on the one hand. And on the other hand is sometimes I just bring back flowers from the supermarket for no reason for you.
I guess I'm kind of on the frugal end of things, and so, like, spending that much money on flowers just seems kind of shocking to me.
Right. And, hey, I wouldn't refuse to go out to dinner with you, but on Valentine's Day, usually, this year, all exceptions, it's like you fight the crowds for, a small space, and...
And the food is usually more expensive on Valentine's Day.
And probably not as good, frankly, because they're slammed, and so they're rushing food out to the tables and all that stuff. I'd rather wait a week or two and then go.
Right. I think I was remembering that we did go out the day before Valentine's Day.
In
2011, the year Anthony was born. He was born on February 20th, so we did do a Valentine's Day sort of, hey, we've got babysitting, let's go out before this baby comes so that, enjoy ourselves.
Because your mom was here.
Well, my sister was living with us at that point.
Oh, right. That's right. That's right. She was still living with us.
So we went out for Indian food that year, and it was nice.
Yeah.
It was like a nice romantic dinner, but not on Valentine's Day, so there wasn't any crowds. Yeah,
and you were a week away from you having a baby.
I was really big. I think somebody in the restaurant was scandalized because I had a glass of wine, and I was just way too pregnant to care what anyone thought.
We've always subscribed to the European thinking on... wine and pregnancy.
Which is a moderate
amount is fine. Doesn't hurt the baby.
My first OB said, like, basically after the first trimester, a small glass of wine one or two times a week is fine.
Right. After the first trimester. And frankly, that kid was ready to come out any minute.
that was the baby who did not wait for the scheduled C-section. He came early.
Yeah. Yes, the giant baby named Anthony. So Valentine's Day. What do we do for Valentine's Day? So instead, we came back from Mass, and the kids all set to making Valentine's
Day. Actually, they were making them before we left for Mass.
That's true. They were making them earlier.
Bella likes to cut out hearts, and she cuts out lots and lots of hearts out of various scrap paper, and then the kids take her hearts and glue them onto construction paper and then draw pictures around them.
Particularly, she likes the foil that the iced tea packets come in. Like, there's a...
Not iced tea, the hot tea.
Right. They come in thin foil packets that are gold on the inside and sometimes silver. And so she cuts them out so that she gets gold and silver.
Bright, bright, shiny hearts. She also had some Star Wars wrapping paper that had like some shiny foil on it.
And an old calendar.
And an old calendar. The calendar was kind of cool because then she ended up with hearts with like the Grand Canyon or a sunset or like masts of sailboats and stuff. It was kind of cool.
There were a lot of Star Wars themed Valentine's cards.
Yes. So basically the kids make cards for each other. And for us. I got one card from Isabella.
I got two, but we had to actually point them out to them that we didn't get cards. And so they started making them.
It's just kind of a very low key thing. I decided that I did want a dessert to celebrate Valentine's Day. So I sort of made a last minute fudge.
We had condensed milk. We had
sweetened condensed milk. I had some random scraps of chocolate. Like I had some baker's chocolate and I had some semi-sweet chocolate chips and I just kind of put it all in a bowl in the microwave. And I stirred in some homemade orange marmalade and some toasted pecans. So I made sort of like orange pecan fudge.
Reviews were mixed.
Some people said it wasn't sweet enough, and that might have been because there was...
That's the baking chocolate, I think.
The baker's chocolate.
Yeah.
There was like some dark chocolate, there was some unsweetened chocolate, and then the semi-sweet. So I think that on the whole, the mix was a little bit too slewed towards dark.
Yeah. And you love dark, but the others are not... Some of the others are not big on dark. But I think it was good. The orange may have been a little... heavy on the orange side a little bit.
See, I was thinking it could have used more orange.
I know you love that orange marmalade.
I really love orange marmalade.
But in the balance of things, I like a hint of orange and chocolate. Orange and chocolate go together really well. Like the chocolate orange, you know, the balls, the
chocolate oranges
you get at Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
Those are good. So yeah, no, I was good. It was enjoyable. But now we have to eat all that fudge before Wednesday.
Well, there's that. Because, I don't think that'll be a problem
because Ash Wednesday is coming.
I mean, if worst comes to worst, I can, like, hide it away in the back of the refrigerator for, you know, a month or two. Whatever. How long
Sundays.
Is it till Easter?
Sundays and Lent.
Okay, whatever. Anyway.
And there's a birthday in there coming up, too. There's a birthday next week.
Yeah, next Saturday is Anthony's birthday. He's already requested cheesecake with chocolate and raspberry swirls.
And Chinese food for dinner.
Hey,
this is actually well in advance of when we usually get such decisions being made.
He's actually he's a child who likes to know what's coming in advance.
Well, he does and he doesn't, because he's also been adamant in not being told what day it is and how many days to his birthday. That's an anxiety coping mechanism for him.
Right, because when he's counting down, I think he's real. I mean, there's some self-awareness here, which is really good.
Yep.
He realizes that the counting down makes him anxious, and so he wants to avoid counting down the days till his birthday. Unfortunately, because he has anxiety, he's just sort of like transferred that to freaking out anytime anybody mentions what day it is. So it's... We're working towards some coping mechanisms.
Yes.
We're getting there.
But in between, before that, we have Ash Wednesday.
Yes.
The weirdest Ash Wednesday. Ash. Let me be clear on what I just said. The weirdest Ash Wednesday that I can remember.
Last year, Ash Wednesday came before the COVID lockdowns.
Yeah, it was like the second or third week of Lent was the last Sunday we were at Mass.
Right. So last year we went to Ash Wednesday Mass at the Pastoral Center. Cardinal Sean celebrated Mass.
That's right.
And
we usually go at the Pastoral Center because it's not that far from us, instead of our parish, because the parish usually has like a weird time.
Yeah.
And then there's a school there, and school masses are just chaos.
They're really long.
Yeah. And they usually have kids doing readings and stuff, which... drives me insane because you have kids who are not ready to read liturgically yet. Like, yeah, anyway, that's a whole nother discussion. So we went to the pastoral, usually go to the Pastoral Center.
This year.
At noon.
This year, we're probably not going to do Mass for Ash Wednesday.
Yeah.
It's not a holy day of obligation. Our parish is doing first come, first serve, but still limited seating. Which means that
you could show up and not be able to get right. in.
And given that it's like a 15-minute drive on a weekday.
And then you got to come back? I mean, it's just we talked about it. We'll watch a mass. They have take-home packets of ashes, but I don't think I'm going to even try to do that. So the Vatican has said, or no, the U.S. bishops have said that because of the whole putting the cross on the forehead is a potential infection vector, that sprinkling is going to be preferred. They're going to that which is what they do in Europe. They, if you've ever seen pictures of the Pope getting ashes on Ash Wednesday, they sprinkle it on his head instead of making a cross on the forehead. But our parish is doing something different. They're doing Q-tips. They're going to draw a cross on your forehead with a Q-tip, probably individually.
Like everybody gets a new Q-tip?
Yeah, that's a lot of Q-tips.
That is a lot of Q-tips.
That has to be disposed of properly because the ashes are blessed. They've been telling us, because with the take-home packets, that's going to be an issue, that these ashes are blessed. They need to be either buried or held, I think they said. You can't really burn them because they're already ashes.
Right. So either put them in a respectful place or bury them in your yard.
Right, which you can't do right now.
Given that it's there's like a foot of snow on the ground.
Yeah, given there's a foot of snow and the yards are the ground is frozen, no one's burying anything right now.
So put it in a respectful place until spring thaw.
I mean, if we were to do it, we'd put it on our altar or our prayer shelf or something.
Right.
But we're not going to do it, and I feel bad because I wish we could.
I think this will be the first Ash Wednesday I can remember not going.
Yes.
I mean, even the year Anthony was born, I think we were home from the hospital. Like, I think I remember taking...
Ash Wednesday was after.
Right. I think I remember taking him as a newborn baby. Like, that was, like, one of the first... That might have been the first mass that I took him to.
Yeah.
It was Ash Wednesday.
Right. So, It's, I'm not thrilled with that. But, it's, you know, we got to do what we got to do this year. So, I'd love to hear what other people are doing, what their parishes are doing. Because... One of the things that's been driven home to me in this whole situation is everybody's situation is different. It really does depend on where you live. You know, people in California are just able to go back to mass inside their churches, whereas there are places where people have been going to mass like normal with no roped off pews or anything.
And no masks and no masks. Restrictions at all.
Yeah, which, but that's a whole other thing. But I'm curious what everyone else is doing. So I'm looking forward to hearing from what people are doing. No hashtag photos this year. Hashtag.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's going to be disappointing. So that's our Ash Wednesday plans. And then, Fat Tuesday and et cetera, et cetera.
We do have Fat Tuesday plans, though.
We do have, yes, we're going to have pancakes and bacon for dinner. We did that a couple of years ago, like three years ago. I think we've done it a couple times since then. So that'll be fun. I'm looking forward to that. The other news is the continuing saga. We need like bumper music for Allergy Watch.
Right.
The latest update on Lucy's allergies is we had another food challenge for her and woohoo, she's clear on peanuts.
Thank goodness.
Yes.
So I stopped by the pharmacy on the way home from the allergist and bought a bag of Reese's peanut butter cups.
The little ones.
The mini ones. These were cool because they were Reese's peanut butter cups, but in the peanut butter filling, they actually had Reese's pieces. So they were like crunchy.
Double Reese's.
So goodness. They were so good. She loved them. She was not a big fan of the peanut, but like we were just in
the M&Ms.
Yeah, in the allergist office, she was just eating plain peanut butter off a spoon.
Yeah.
She was like not super thrilled with this because it was not sweetened or anything. It was just plain salted peanut.
The Teddy's plain peanut butter.
But you're also supposed to, for the food challenge, you're supposed to have as pure as possible. So she was not thrilled with the taste. And so she was not very excited as we left the allergist. She was like, yay, peanuts.
She was
really skeptical about the peanut butter cup. But she was like, oh, okay, I'll try it. Not expecting much. And then she was very pleasantly surprised.
Yes.
And she proceeded to eat a whole bunch of them. And so now she's well on her way to liking peanut butter treats, at least.
Yes. We'll have to work on the peanut butter sandwich thing and that sort of stuff.
She may never be a peanut butter sandwich eater.
Well, that's what we were talking about, how is like with her allergies and just her being acclimated to them. She may never, she may never like some of these things, but she may never be someone who eats it like people who've always eaten it do. Right. So can eat peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, but she may just never be interested.
Then again, Sophie does not like peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and refuses to eat them. Well, so, and she's never had a peanut allergy. She just doesn't like peanut butter and jelly.
Yeah.
So everybody has their own tastes.
Yeah. Well, so the last thing left is corn. And even then you said it was a toss up on whether to test her for corn or for peanuts.
I think that she's going to pass the corn with flying colors.
Oh my gosh. I want to I want to celebrate.
She will have zero food allergies.
I want to have like a dish that has corn and wheat and dairy and eggs and peanuts. I'm not sure there is one.
I could put like
shepherd's pie with peanuts.
No.
I'm not sure if there is something, or just even a dinner that has all the things in it.
Actually, she might still be allergic to hazelnuts, which were the one nut that she actually had like
a reaction to.
Yeah, when the one time we tried hazelnuts, she had like swelling, itchy lips and stuff. Mm. So she's been a little bit hesitant on hazelnuts, but
it's like Bella is allergic to cashews. I mean, I'm happy that she's clear on peanuts because those are the most common.
And she can have pistachios and pecans and almonds. So she's really got a fairly wide range of nut products that she can eat.
Yeah. So that's good.
Anyway.
So, yes. So the other thing we started talking about, was that today or last night? I think it was last night at dinner. Was I've been thinking, what are we going to do for summer vacation? And I know it's February. Oh. Part of that is it's February and I need to think about something nice and sunny and not cold and
icy. This is usually a good time of year too, because if you wait until spring,
you wait too late, everything's booked.
Yeah.
So, now, the problem is what will we be able to do?
Right. What will be open?
Right. So, the last year we got the cottage on the lake. It wasn't exactly inexpensive. And it was nice, but it's sort of you're in the cottage and that's all you do. And I like to alternate that with doing something where you go someplace and see things and do things. But are you going to be able to do that? Like, do we go camping somewhere? Can we go camping? Will campgrounds be open? Will everyone be camping because they don't want to go take summer vacations that require flying? So they want to drive places? Like, these are all the questions in my mind, and I just don't know. And even if you can go someplace, will anything be open to do? Like, if we went to like Gettysburg again, say, which we wouldn't because we decided summer in Gettysburg is not the best time to go because of the heat. But like, would stuff be open?
Right. And you'd have to do a lot of research to find like specific, because sometimes it's not even just state specific. Sometimes it's,
Right. And locale. Things will change between now and then. So who knows? So, and then we have the added wrinkle of scout camp. So now three of them are potentially going to scout camp. My hope is that the two troops go together at the same time.
Which is likely because there's leadership.
The leaders.
Overlap
right,
between.
The assistant scout masters and that sort of stuff. And siblings and that sort of thing in the two troops. That would be, for the parents, I think, would be love to have that happen that way. So,
right.
So we've got that wrinkle, though, which is a whole nother thing, which is a whole nother expense. The three of them at scout camp is not cheap. So, I don't know. I want to do something. I don't want to just, not do stuff, but maybe we just need to keep waiting a little bit longer to see what happens with the vaccines and all that sort of stuff. 2021 is working up to be another year of uncertainty and whatever. If you're thinking of doing something, I'd love to hear what you're going to do and what you think you're going to be able to do. and how, you know, what you're thinking about your summer vacation. And did you go on vacation last summer? I think a lot of people didn't even get a chance to go away. They were so locked down. So 2 years without a vacation, that might be a little crazy. So we'll see.
I want to at least do something.
We need to do something. Yeah. Even if it's, just drive to a campground on the Cape, you know, stay in state in Massachusetts or go to a state park or whatever's open. Like, that's the thing. I'm not even sure what's going to be open. Anyway. So let's talk about food. We have more about food because Lucy was, her allergies are falling by the wayside. I decided to bring out one of our old favorite recipes that we haven't made in a long time. And it's a Chinese recipe.
This is because it has eggs in it.
It had enough. Yeah. Well, it had eggs and cornstarch and other things. Had enough of the allergens where it just became like, you can't substitute enough things. We might as well just make something else. And so we stopped making it. But it's called Chicken Sung. And I got the recipe out of a cookbook by Irene Kuo. It's an old cookbook. I'm not even sure it's in print anymore, but it's a classic. The Basics of Chinese Cooking, I think it is, something like that. I forget. I'll put it in the show notes if I get it. But so it's there's several steps. And the first step is you have to velvet the chicken, which is a Chinese technique where you coat the chicken in cornstarch and egg white and a little bit of sherry, or, you know, if you have Chinese Shaoxing wine, which you would do, but that's hard to come by. So sherry, and perhaps something else. And then in a little sesame oil, I think. And then you let that marinate in the fridge. Then after a half hour, you put it in oil. You heat up some vegetable oil, but only to a simmer, not too hot, because you're not trying to sizzle it. You're not trying to fry it. You're just trying to gently cook the outside. You're not even going to cook it all the way through. Just until it turns white.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it's supposed to take like a minute. It never takes a minute for me because I don't know. Maybe I don't have the heat up high enough. But
well, because we don't have a gas range, we have a
electric glass top range. Right, that's true. So
if we had gas, it would take a minute.
Yeah, probably.
Our stovetop doesn't get hot enough.
Well, it's not supposed to be too hot though. But maybe the oil is supposed to be hotter than I'm taking it. But I think it's 270, or no, it's not 270. I forget what it is. Anyway, I should bring up the recipe so I could be talking about this instead of guessing. So let me open up Paprika, which is my recipe software of choice, which is fantastic. If you have Mac, it is the one you should get. So the cookbook is The Keys to Chinese Cooking by Irene Kuo. And then you heat it, the oil to 275. You throw in the chicken, the coated chicken, you let it
but I'm thinking the difference between gas and electric might still be that once you put the chicken in, gas might get it back up to up to temperature faster than electric,
because electric does the on and off maintaining.
So I think that this, it still makes a difference in terms of like the chicken is going to bring the oil temperature down
because it's cold out of the fridge,
because it's cold. And it's not going to come up as fast.
This is true.
On electric versus gas.
That's true. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, the thing is, you're supposed to heat the wok to very hot, then turn it down to medium, add the oil, and then add in the chicken. But yeah, that's all gonna, you can't do all that with the electric. I hate electric stoves. I wish we had a gas stove. We had one gas stove in our time at the apartment in Danvers. Peabody. I always say Danvers. It was on the line of the town line. It was in Peabody.
Yeah. And this house, it's not even an option. There is no gas line.
There's no gas in the street. We'd have to get propane tanks, which some neighbors I've seen have.
Do they?
Yeah. Like the big outdoor propane tanks. Somewhere on the next road over, I saw a house that had it. Yeah, it's tempting, but not high on my list of things. No. So anyway, you velvet it. Then you cook mushrooms. Like diced mushrooms, diced water chestnuts, peas, some ginger, and you cook it all together with it comes together really quick after that with the chicken, and then it's really simple, and there's a seasoning, that there's this little sauce made of soy sauce, sherry, and sugar, that goes into like a sauce on it and then comes off, and you serve it with lettuce leaves or rice sticks, they say, but we've always done the lettuce leaves, sort of like a little packet. You put the sung in it. So good. So simple. Like the dish itself ends up being simple. Now, because we still have cornstarch questions, I used a mixture of tapioca starch and arrowroot instead of the cornstarch.
I don't think there's much difference, really.
Between tapioca starch and arrowroot, or between those and cornstarch?
Between those and cornstarch.
Right. There has been, I think I mentioned before, a food scientist who told me online that the allergens are in the proteins, which are not in the cornstarch, that the cornstarch doesn't have the stuff.
No, I was just saying, in terms of the texture and taste, there's not a difference.
Oh, right. Yeah, it worked out fine. Yeah. I didn't detect any issue. Arrowroot is really, you can really substitute it for cornstarch in almost everything.
Yeah, I like it. It's not as cheap as cornstarch, but other than that.
Yes. So that was good. I liked, I was really happy to have it. I'm glad I made it. Bella was so nostalgic because she remembers it. She used to love it as a kid. She was like, oh, chicken sung. Oh, I remember that. Because it's been so long. At least four or five years.
In the spring, we make it with the pea tendrils in it, too. And I really like that. I think that's what I was missing.
We haven't gotten pea tendrils in a while, have we?
No, I think the vendor that at the farmer's market that had those stopped selling.
Do you remember the Vietnamese farmers in Marblehead?
Yeah, they had the
best. Oh my gosh, they were awesome. They had so many interesting, cool vegetables. But the Second Nature used to have them when it was the other farm couple. Yeah, things change. So then, to go with that, I made some green beans. I had picked up some green beans at the supermarket, and we've been trying to get Anthony to eat more vegetables. He'll just pick through and eat just the meat of things, and it's like pulling teeth to get him to eat some vegetables. So a lot of his texture, I think when the vegetables are too soft, he just doesn't like that.
But he also doesn't like it too crunchy.
But he doesn't like it too crunchy, right? He has to be just right.
His sweet spot is really hard. And he can't even tell you, like tonight with the green beans, he couldn't tell me. He didn't like the texture, but he couldn't tell me if he wanted it crunchier or mushier. Like, is it too hard or too soft? I don't know.
So, this was actually not with the chicken sung. This was the soy sauce wings, because he'd asked me to make this ginger soy dipping sauce that I'd made for another dish a few months ago for the wings, because he wanted to be able to dip his wings in it. And I said, sure, if he likes that. And then I said to him, I had a little brainstorm. What if I cooked the green beans in the ginger soy dipping sauce? And he's like, oh, okay, I'll try that. And I'm like, ding, 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 let's do that. So what I did was I parboiled the green beans, 4 minutes in the boiling water, then drained them, put them in the wok, and with some oil. And I really wanted to really kind of give them a little bit of a char, like a little bit of a browning. I didn't want char on it. I wanted it to be just like a little bit of start the browning on it, which I didn't even really get that far with it. I don't think it did. I was thinking of there's a dish that sometimes I get at the Chinese restaurant, a garlic string beans dish that I get sometimes, where the green beans are a little bit snappier. So I threw them in there, cooked them for a bit, and then I added some of the garlic soy dipping sauce to it. And it was really good. He liked it. I liked it. Right? It was pretty good. And so that worked out. But you tried a little something different tonight. We had Sunday gravy and pasta again. I hadn't had that in a while, so I wanted to do that tonight.
I wanted to do an Italian-style green beans. And so I just cooked up some cherry tomatoes with garlic and threw in some oregano and basil and a little bit of white wine.
White vinegar?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Just like a splash. And because it was what I found on the shelf when I was in a hurry.
It was white wine vinegar?
Yeah, white wine vinegar.
Not distilled white vinegar.
No, white wine vinegar.
Yes.
Uh, And that was really good. But I think he didn't dislike the taste so much as the texture. Although I think really he just wanted to eat pasta and was resenting the fact that I was making him stop to eat green beans.
Yes, he just wanted to eat more pasta, more sausage, more bread.
But I thought but Bella liked the green beans, so did Sophie. Lucy was not a fan, but she ate some plain. I left a few green beans without the tomato and sauce, and she liked the plain ones, so that was a win, I suppose.
And then the cauliflower.
I made a Parmesan cauliflower. I tossed it with, I made some breadcrumbs, like Parmesan breadcrumbs with some onion and garlic powder and salt and
butter and oil.
Butter, oil, and
then you just
little oregano, I think.
Right.
And I just
toss them together.
I tossed the cauliflower in the butter and oil, and then I tossed them in the cheesy breadcrumbs, and then I roasted them at 425.
Sheet pan in the oven for 20 minutes?
A little bit longer than 20 minutes. It was more like 30 minutes.
Oh, okay.
But I checked it at 20 and then went there.
It was like having garlic bread.
They were really good.
They were very good. Very popular.
Well,
among those who would eat such things. Yeah. Bella and Sophie and you and I like them.
Lucy was not a fan. Anthony was resentful and angry, and Ben wouldn't even try it.
Anthony likes garlic bread, but he's like, it tastes like cauliflower.
it can't possibly taste like garlic bread because it's going to taste like... I don't think he gave it a fair try.
Yeah, I think he had already decided what it was going to taste like.
Yeah.
So that's what we've been cooking.
Oh, and then I also made beer bread today.
Oh, yes. The best use of a can of Budweiser ever.
You bought the Budweiser for some recipe.
The fish and chips.
Oh, fish and beer batter fish.
Yes.
So we had a 6-pack of Budweiser.
I'd only used 2 cans of it, so there had been 4 cans left.
Yeah, so I made an overnight beer bread, no knead. It's basically, it's just like 3 cups of flour and some yeast and salt and a little bit of oil and then a can of beer. Super easy. Just stir it up. You don't have to knead it at all.
Throw it in the freezer, a fridge.
No. You let it rise for a couple hours and then fold it a couple times, you just fold the edges in.
You're not kneading, you're just folding.
Yeah. And then let it rise another couple hours and then fold it again and then stick it in the fridge overnight and then take it out, let it come to room temperature, fold it, let it rise a little bit, and then make it into a loaf and let it rise and then bake it. So there's a lot of letting it rise. This is supposed to be somewhere between 18 to 24 hours or even longer.
Mm-hmm.
But the timing is really laid back. Fold it whenever you kind of think about it and you have time, and it's risen some. It's not like you have to watch the clock and set a timer, and if you miss the time, then you're going to ruin the bread. This is lazy person bread. And it came out, the flavor was really nice.
Yes, it was really good. It was very soft.
A very soft crumb inside, but a nice crust outside. I cooked it in a 450 degree oven in my Dutch oven. So you put the Dutch oven in the oven to preheat and let it get really hot. And then you drop your bread in and then put the lid on it.
It gives it a spring, that heat from the Dutch oven. It really...
And it gives it a nice crust.
Yeah.
So that was a successful use of Budweiser.
Yes. The best use of Budweiser ever. Although one of our friends gave us a link to a recipe for a beer cheese sauce, which may be another good use of Budweiser.
See, I think you need the beer bread and the beer cheese sauce together.
To go together? Sure. I'm for that.
What are you going to dip in your cheese sauce but beer bread, right? Spoon.
But yes, you could put the bread in it too.
So that might be on the slate for next week.
Yeah, that should be good. Next Sunday, maybe. All right. So that's what we've been eating. Let's talk about what we've been reading. So I finished this week. I started this week, finished this week. I knew it was going to happen. I read Peace Talks, the penultimate, not penultimate, but the second most recent of the Harry Dresden files, the Dresden Files novels by Jim Butcher, featuring Harry Dresden, the wizard detective. Right.
2 books came out last year, Peace Talks and Battleground, and they came out 2 months apart.
Yeah.
They're really 2 halves of a novel
story.
And of a novel that got too big and needed to be chopped in half.
Yeah, the way this one ends is like, that's it? Like, wait, we're about to go to this next thing.
Where... Yeah, but at least you get to read the next one right away. I had to wait the 2 months.
Exactly.
Actually, I think I read it twice in the 2 month interval. Like, uh-huh. I read it, and then I read it again right before Battleground came out to have Peace Talks fresh in my head again.
So my thought about it is, I mean, I'm delighted to be able to read another Dresden Files novel, so that's good. I felt like the stakes are getting too big, like for Dresden. It started out, in fact, he says it in the novel at one point. Like this, you know, I used to just do, you know, cases finding lost pets, you know, that sort of thing. Or, you know, he used to do small cases. And now all the time it's always world changing consequences. It's like Doctor Who. Everything is like, I have to save the universe every episode, you know? And it's like, after a while, if you have a constant diet of this really high level, like the tension, you lose the tension a little.
Although what I like about it, I'm going to play devil's advocate because I can see your point. And yet at the same time, I kind of like the fact that he's also interested, though, in what are the real world effects of these big world changing things, because it's not without consequences. Like, it's not just like we have this big battle and then like everything goes back to normal and we're fine. Like, every time there's a big throwdown, there's consequences in the world.
Yes and no. Like, it's not like a TV show where we reset back to the status quo ante from the beginning of the episode. I get that. That's true. The things that happens in the world are, they have consequences. People die, things break, relationships end, that sort of stuff. And yes.
And in a way, what's happening now is the consequences of what happened. What Harry's been breaking the world, and now he has to deal with the consequences of the things he broke.
Yeah, I mean, I get that. And I have to,
I like that. I like the fact that when he does things without really thinking through, there are big world changing consequences. Sure. And there is a mess that he ends up stuck with.
Well, and I do like that there are consequences and that it's logically thought out. And I also like that the previous book was smaller stakes. It was a heist novel. Like, it was a heist story, which is smaller. And I mean, it literally featured the Hades, but it was a smaller story. Let's just put it that way. Whereas this one, yeah, I get that. I mean, it's not a huge complaint. I still really enjoy the novel. And I'm still really wicked curious where it's going. But another thing, though, that a little bit bothered me was there's a situation in this one where Harry has some knowledge of a thing. And there's another important character who is acting on Harry doing something with that knowledge, not having that knowledge. Like, if Harry would just tell the other person, communicate, look, this is why I'm doing this, the other person would be able to go, oh, I understand. So I don't think that you're a traitor or a jerk or a bad guy.
Right. I do agree
it
with this.
It bugs me when writers do that in general.
Right. It has been a crutch through the series from like one of the first novels.
Right.
Harry has a character flaw of not telling people. And
it's a wizard thing, right? Wizards, like Gandalf had a habit in The Lord of the Rings of not telling the entire story to everyone.
Right, it's partly a wizard thing, and partly I think
partly it's a Harry thing.
It's a Harry thing, and there is some character building, like it is built into his character, like there are reasons why he acts like this, like he has some
built-in
insecurities and baggage and stuff. So, on the one hand, it's annoying because it feels like a crutch that, like, too many writers go to the, like, miscommunication basket for building tension in a novel, and that annoys me.
Well, it's part of it's the repeated confrontations, like there's multiple confrontations at which the information could get revealed and we could defuse the situation. But we've refused to reveal the information in this confrontation so that we can maintain the tension until the next time. Like, it just doesn't feel realistic that someone would one after the other after the other. That's all. And I'm not saying, you know, it's a fatal flaw. It's frustrating reading it that way. Because I know that if you would just say it.
Right. Well, this is one reason why I cannot stand the works of David Mamet, because like David Mamet his entire shtick is people not communicating with each other. Yes. And that just drives me batty. I cannot stand that, like, stories where the entire story is just people who don't.
And there are TV shows where that's the entire shtick. Like the entire series is that. It's like, ah!
No,
like, it drives me crazy. On the other hand, what I really liked about this one is something that Butcher continues to do with the Harry Dresden novels, which is he takes characters who were originally sort of throwaway, flat, or, you know, villains, and rounds them out and gives them fullness. And they become, they're not good guys necessarily, but they're, as one point Harry says, "You're my best frenemy." You know, it's like we're not friends, and you will hurt me if you need to, given the chance. But you're also willing to do a good thing that's in this situation because it suits your purposes. It's just the characters are more well rounded.
I feel like Butcher does not do flat villains. And if somebody seems like a flat villain in one book, they will likely come back in a later book to be more rounded.
Yeah, although there are a few. Well, even Nick is he's about as evil of a character, but there's still a couple of there's a couple things that happened in the previous book that give him some character. Like, hey, he loves somebody.
Right. He's evil. He's bad. But he's also,
there's still a humanity.
There's a little bit,
a little glimmer of humanity left.
He hasn't lost all of his humanity.
Right.
And yeah.
So there's that. The big baddies here, the Fomor, which are they're like evil magical people from under the ocean.
They're based in Irish mythology.
Okay. So far they're just bad. So
yeah, I don't think that. Right. I mean,
there are some who are just bad.
Well, because with magical creatures, you can have, like, a magical race that are evil. Like, vampires are just evil.
Or are they? That's the question, right? Some of them aren't completely evil.
Well, he kind of gets around that by having different kinds of vampires.
Right.
So there are vampires who are more evil, and there are vampires who are less
The Black Court
evil.
Vampires are, like, the undead. Right. Well, also, like, the ghouls, they're pretty much evil. There is nothing good about the ghouls.
Right.
So... I'm going to pick up Battleground next. That's the next one. I finished the Peace Talks last night, so I'll start reading Battleground today. You finished a book?
I did. I read a book in one day. I was at so on Tuesday, I was at the Allergist for a couple hours with Lucy, and I had my Kindle with me, but I didn't feel like reading The Corner That Held Them, which is kind of a slow moving novel. I wanted something.
That's the one about the Abbey.
The medieval nuns, which is really good. I'm really liking it. But I just, I know. I checked my email, and one of the books that I'd been waiting for on hold at the library, like, came in and I could check it out. So I was like, well, I'll check that out. And it's a science fiction novel that my sister had recommended. It's called The Space Between Worlds. It's a recent novel. I think it came out like last year or the year before, maybe a few years ago. Anyway, so it is a parallel universe novel, you know, multiplicity of worlds.
Multiverse,
yes. There's a multiverse, and you can exist in, you exist in multiple universes. In each one, they're slightly different because of different choices that characters made. So in this one, the wrinkle is that you can only travel to a parallel world in which your parallel self has died. So you have this big corporation which has the broken, they have the breakthrough technology which allows them to go to other worlds, and they're mining them for information primarily. Like, what, looking at other worlds and seeing how things are different the further away they get from Earth Zero. But in order to go to those other worlds, you have to be dead in them. So what they found is that the people who are most likely to be dead in more than one world are people who come from backgrounds of instability.
Poverty, war-torn areas.
Right.
Yeah.
So one of them is a guy who was a child soldier in Africa. And so he obviously has, in many of his parallel lives, he was killed in the war. And so he's able to travel to a bunch of worlds. Our protagonist is born in poverty to a mother who's drug addicted. And so she's like, in many of her parallel universes, she doesn't make it for all sorts of reasons.
372 worlds.
In 372 worlds, she's died.
And I'm so, looking at the description on Amazon.
Right. And so I think they can only travel to about 400 worlds, maybe. I mean, not very many. Like, if it gets too far away, it's just too different and they can't get there.
Right.
So she, and what the company does, because they're keeping costs low, is if they try to use one person to cover as many worlds as possible. And so every time one of herself dies in another world, they fire the person. Like, if a person can only go to worlds where other people can go, they fire them. Like, your job security rests on being the only person who can go to certain worlds.
Okay.
So if you have no exclusive claim, then they'll just fire you and use people who can go to those worlds.
Right.
So as the novel opens, one woman is being let go because now our protagonist's self has died in one of the parallel worlds. And that was the last one that she had exclusivity in.
Right. So if you've lost this exclusivity in all the worlds that you can go to, then they fire you.
Right. Because you are now redundant.
Right. Okay. And so.
So it's kind of a small novel in a way, because the only worlds that we see her going to, like where she's traveling in the worlds, is not to distant places. She's traveling to the same location.
Okay.
And she's meeting. So basically she's meeting the same characters of people. She's meeting all of the people she knows in her own world in these parallel worlds.
They're just slightly different.
Slightly different people. And so that's kind of interesting, because what thing allows the author to do, allows the story to do, rather, is to trace the effects of free will and choice. And so you see characters who are either, you know, they're different in these different worlds because of either choices that they made or choices that other people made. And so you can kind of see that, like, there's a similarity across all of the different possibilities. You have character traits which remain largely the same. And there's a real, the novel's really interested in especially looking at trauma,
mm-hmm,
and how trauma shapes people. And people end up making the same bad choices over and over again, in partly because they're stuck in bad situations.
Interesting.
But what I liked about it is there's like one character who is her former boyfriend, I suppose you could say, former love interest. He was very abusive and she has escaped from him. And he's the emperor of Ashtown, which is sort of basically the world is divided into the city and the wastelands. It's a post-apocalyptic world. But in one of the parallel worlds she goes to, he's not a sadistic, murdering, abusive megalomaniac. He's really kind. But his older brother, who in her world had died as a child, is the sadistic, abusive, megalomaniac ruler. And so it's almost like because their father was all of those things. And so it's like one of the two brothers has to take on the role of the father. But when in the world where his older brother survives, it gives him space to actually become a kind person.
Hmm.
Which is interesting, because it really looks at like both how we're the product of our environments, but also we are the product of our choices, because in the world where he's kind, he had the opportunity of killing his brother and opted not to.
Nature, nurture, and choice.
And choice. So it really, I really liked the fact that the novel explored that nature, nurture, and choice, and free will. And that in the end, it turns out that our character survives. She's the one of herself that survives, in part because she's resilient and strong and she has grit, but also because she's kind. She finds out that, you know, she's got a sister who has realized that something, that she's a sister in one of the parallel worlds that she's able to visit, who realizes that she's not her old self mm-hmm. because she's kind.
Interesting. But like she comes in at the, like if herself is, if she's dead in that world, don't people say like, oh, hey, where'd you come from? I thought you were dead.
Right. She usually goes in sort of under cover of darkness. She's kind of a spy. Like she's going uh-huh. in, doing a data download and then going back again most of the time.
Okay.
So it's just sort of like they've got some sort of a spy station and she's just collecting the data dump.
Okay.
And so they have a way of disguising her. Like she often goes in cover of darkness and they have this sort of veil mask thing that she can wear that disguises her features. It works mm-hmm. unless you get too close.
Okay.
I liked a lot of it. There was, it got really dark at some times because it is trauma. It's also interesting in identity questions. There's some question of like racial identity. She turns out to be Black, which wasn't clear to me until more than halfway through the novel, which was actually kind of interesting.
Hmm.
There were hints. There's like suggestions that people in the city have lighter skin and people outside the city have darker skin. But it's also partly because of environment, like outside the city has like bright, deadly sun and inside the city they're under a protective dome. And so I thought it was just like environmental.
Right.
And then it turns out as the story goes on that there's probably like a racial element, like the people in the city tend to be white background and the people outside tend to be other races.
Okay.
There's also some gender questions, which didn't get too heavy-handed, but it is definitely an element in the story. She has a romantic interest in another woman, and there's a character who is sort of non-binary gender, but it's not an overwhelming element in the...
Right, it's not banging you over the head with it.
Right, it's...
Like Star Trek Discovery.
and I really felt like it was handled in a way that was sort of thematically in keeping with the other questions of free will, choice, and identity.
These days, with science, especially with science fiction books, you can't help but see that sort of stuff showing up. It's just, it's there, you know. So if it's handled deftly and not too heavily.
And there, as far as graphic content goes, there's no graphic romantic or sex scenes. There is a little bit of graph descriptions of violence.
Okay. So it came out in August.
Oh, okay. So it's
brand new.
Brand new.
But New York Times, book review editor's choice, and lots of
One last thought I wanted to say, because I don't want to belabor it, but I really liked the resolution in this story, which was not the big Hunger Games dystopian world-building revolution. It had a much quieter resolution, and it was a resolution that left room for people to grow and change and mm-hmm. change their minds, as opposed to like a fight to the death.
Okay. So just a couple things I want to talk about for having watched this past week. I watched on Netflix, there was a movie. I just wanted to watch something mindless. I watched this Jason Statham movie. He's the British action hero star. Called Homefront, where he is a DEA agent who retires with his daughter to like in the Bayou, Louisiana, like backwoods Louisiana. And there's a biker gang that wants to take revenge on him. And James Franco plays a meth dealer, manufacturer, I guess, the Breaking Bad guy,
mm-hmm.
Who gets, there's a whole like, feud between families thing that happens. It's violent. And it's funny because it kind of fails at the tropes of action movies. Like it introduces characters like you're like, oh, she's the romantic interest. She's going to be in danger at some point. Nope. They introduce this romantic interest and do nothing with her. Like absolutely nothing.
Like, weird.
Like there's several characters who are like, oh, that's that trope, and that's that trope. And it's like, nope, they don't do anything. Like, why did you even introduce that character? Like, it's just because, darn it, an action movie where the hero is a widower and has a daughter needs to have a love interest for the daughter to push at the dad or something. I don't know. It was very strange. It was interesting. It was interesting to see the setting in Louisiana. It wasn't too heavy on the, it was a little heavy on the redneck stereotypes, but there were good rednecks and bad rednecks, so it wasn't all bad. So anyway, Homefront, it was on Netflix. I finished watching the limited series of The Stand, which is on CBS All Access.
It's the Stephen King.
The Stephen King. So yet another adaptation of Stephen King's novel.
You know, I know the title. I don't know anything about the story of The Stand.
I didn't either. So it's apparently a post-apocalyptic story.
So we both read, you watched and I read post-apocalyptic stories.
Yes. So what happens is a disease. This is great timing for this, that is fast acting and wipes out 90% of the population of the world.
Aha. Uh-huh.
You know, nearly 7 billion people. There's a woman, 100 plus year old woman in Boulder, Colorado, who it keeps appearing in people's dreams. She says, God has called you to come to see me in Colorado. And she calls all these people to her in Colorado. Meanwhile, there's this guy named Russell Flagg, who is the messenger of the devil, and he's calling people to where else? Las Vegas. And this is on streaming, so it's full of graphic violence, graphic sexual content. So I was not pleased with that part of it. But despite that, it's remarkably Christian in its outlook. I mean, the battle between good and evil is stark. There is clearly good and clearly evil. Evil does this stuff, which frankly is a condemnation of the world we live in now. It's kind of interesting. Whereas good does this. Good is self-sacrificial and loving and brings children into the world, whereas evil is the opposite and can only mock good.
Reminds me of what my uncle Phil always says, which is he says that horror as a genre tends to be very there's a strong moral center and bad is bad and good is good.
Right.
You see that in
for horror to work, there has to be a bad guy who has to be bad.
Right. For horror to work and also mystery novels, the mystery genre tends to be that way. Like good is good and bad is bad and bad is punished and good is rewarded.
Yes.
Justice is served.
Right.
There's something about those genres that really does help to they keep them on a moral because it doesn't work otherwise.
So the Christian message in it is really interesting. Like this, there's temptation, to give in, to worship me and I will give you the world sort of stuff, or I will give you these things that you love that you've lost or potentially lost, or I will protect them for you, or that sort of thing. There are people who sacrifice themselves for others. Those elements were really good. But with the sexual and violent content, it was gory, unnecessarily gory at parts. And I almost didn't watch the last two episodes because I just was kind of fed up with it. The thing is when I found out, there's just two more episodes. All right. I'll power through it just to see how it ends. It wraps up way too quick. It spends six episodes building up this story, and then suddenly it's like the producers looking like, oh, we've only got two episodes left. Oh, we got to do all this stuff now. And everything happens in two episodes. In fact, everything kind of happens in one episode, the penultimate episode, the second to last episode, all the resolution. And then there's a little more story in the last episode. And it's like this, I think this is the problem with this limited series format of nine episodes. Like, if this were a four-episode mini classic miniseries from the 80s, right? You're too young to remember that. But, the TV miniseries, like The Roots, or actually there were Stephen King miniseries on TV in the 80s, where it was two nights or four hours, two hours, or it was something like that. And if they did this in 4 hours, it would have been better, frankly. It either had to be 4 hours or it had to be 16 hours. It's like they dragged out the middle part because they had to fill nine episodes But then when you get to a point, you're like, okay, now it's time to wrap it up.
Hmm.
Yeah, so I was a little disappointed with that. I've heard that the version of this from the 90s was better. So I may actually seek it out, because I kind of like post-apocalyptic stuff sometimes.
Uh-huh.
I find the people surviving in these extreme circumstances interesting. So.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of post-apocalyptic literature.
Yeah. All right, you had a YouTube video you wanted to talk about. And then we'll wrap it up for
right. Me. Yeah, I haven't really watched any TV or movies, but I have spent a couple of evenings watching this really long interview that I found on YouTube with the poet Richard Wilbur. And it's divided up really interestingly so that into a bunch of small segments, each one titled sort of thematically. But it's obviously one interview that kind of flows seamlessly one section into the next. So if you play it as a playlist, it kind of plays the whole thing, but you could also just listen to little chunks. And I think the whole thing is there's 83 snippets that are between 1 minute and 10 minutes long of the video.
So is it 83?
There's 83 videos
wow.
in the YouTube playlist. And it's just, it's part of a series called Web of Stories, Life Stories of Remarkable People. And this YouTube channel has dozens of stories. Some of them are scientists. Most of them are not actually writers or poets. There's scientists and screen like directors and people who I've never heard of, most uh-huh. of them. But I really like Richard Wilbur. He and I didn't know much about him. I've read a handful of his poems, and it turns out that he is a guy who fought in World War II and came back and went back to school on the GI Bill.
Okay.
And that's how he ended up becoming a university professor. And I mean, he taught at a lot of Ivy League schools, including Harvard, and knew Robert Frost. And so he has lots of really interesting stories just about his life, about his work as a poet, teaching university classes. He talks about how at one point Harvard was talking about introducing, I think it was Harvard, might have been in a different school, was talking about introducing a creative writing major, and how he and John Updike, the two creative writing people, creative people
uh-huh.
On the committee, were the two who were opposed to making it a major. He said, John Updike said that in order to be a successful writer, one has to know something about the world.
Okay.
And so really he thinks that in order to be a writer, you have to major in something other than writing.
Okay.
Study chemistry or biology or even literature, but history, but study something other than writing. And I thought that was interesting.
That is interesting.
Anyway, he's a really good storyteller, and he's got a great voice. And I just, and he does a lot of, towards the end of the interview, he does a lot of poetry readings. And that's how I started actually, I think, looking for a reading of one of his poems. And then I stumbled on oh, there's 83 videos here.
That's a lot of editing. Do you know how long it is, in total? Is it hours and hours?
It's really hard to tell. Some of them, the clips are 1 minute, 55 seconds.
Okay.
5 minutes, 3 minutes, 4 minutes, two minutes.
It's got to be a couple hours.
It's probably, I don't think any of them are longer than about 8 minutes.
Well, it's probably even more than 83. Even if they were 1 minute each, it'd be over an hour. So
right.
Probably 2-3 hours worth.
He gets sort of all his parents, his childhood, his entire life story.
Okay.
So it's as good as I honestly don't like reading biographies very much. Unless they're really well written, I tend to get bored and distracted and just wander off. And I have all sorts of biographies on my shelf that I've never read. I've never read a biography
Finished.
I've read the first chapter. I've read the first chapter of the biography of Jane Austen that I own, and I got bored because it was all about like her brothers and going to sea and being sailors and her world. And it was just like, tell me about Jane. I'm bored. I know I could skip ahead, but I have a hard time skipping ahead in books. It's like, either hold my attention or don't hold my attention.
It's like fast forwarding through a movie or something. It's like,
right.
I'm either gonna watch the movie or not gonna watch the movie. I'm either gonna read the book or not read the book.
But like, yeah, skipping around. I mean, if I'm reading it for like a particular project, like for school, I might skim. But sure. But if I'm reading on my own time, I don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so okay. This was a great way to spend some time learning about a poet that I like.
Nice.
And maybe I'll watch more YouTube videos. I like you. I'm sort of discovering this year, I think, that YouTube is a great source of,
oh yeah,
content.
I watch so many YouTube channels about so many different
things. It's funny because I used to think of YouTube as being primarily just like sort of something that you do occasionally when you're like bored or somebody links to something interesting but short, and I'm actually finding YouTube to be more of like,
it's like TV to me now.
Right,
like there are certain channels I watch that are like TV shows. Like I watch the Townsend channel, which the, you know, 18th century life
right,
reenactment, and then the Smarter Every Day, which I've started downloading those for the kids to watch, you know, because they're sciencey, fun sciencey videos. Yeah, and then tons of different cooking ones, like the rancher, Ken. Oh, what's his name? Anyway, but
I'm old enough to remember when YouTube was like people uploading cat videos.
Right. There was a lot of uploading either of like just people being silly, or cat videos, or like actually, frankly, the stuff you see on TikTok now.
Right.
You know, the reels. Or they were uploading clips from shows, which are still there, mm-hmm, clips from TV shows and stuff. There's so much there. That's the thing. There's a lot of good content. All right, let's wrap it up there.
Okay.
We want to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create Raising the Bets, including Father Daryl M., William C., Jeremy S., Joanne M., and Christine G. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Raising the Bets and all the shows at StarQuest. Now's a great time to become a StarQuest patron, thanks to a generous gift from a StarQuest supporter. When you start a new Patreon monthly pledge at sqpn.com/give, the first 3 months will be matched by an equal amount from our donor. So that supports all our shows, including this one, making your gift go even further. So if you've been thinking of becoming a StarQuest patron, now's the time. Visit sqpn.com/give today. So what do you think of our discussion? Do you have any feedback for us? We'd love to hear you about what you're doing for Ash Wednesday, what Ash Wednesday is going to be like for you this year, what you're doing for summer vacation. I definitely want to hear from people their summer vacation ideas. And anything else we talked about, you can comment at sqpn.com/bets, that's BETTS, or the SQPN Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia, or send an email to bets@sqpn.com. And of course, all the links for all of our discussion are in our show notes, the books, the videos, etc., etc. They'll be on sqpn.com. If you can, we really do appreciate it. We haven't had one in a while, but if you can write a review of the podcast at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from, and share the podcast with your friends, that helps us grow our community. Until next time, I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest.